Welcome to the U-Turn Podcast. This is the place to connect to who you truly are. We're bringing PhDs, experts, and leaders to help you elevate your mindset in your work life and in your love life so that you can see things differently and truly love your world. I'm Ashley Stahl. I'm a career expert, author, and TEDx speechwriter and booker, and I'm excited to bring you in to this week's episode. U-Turn friends, you know that I bring you special people, and today is no exception. I'm bringing Matthew Hussey onto the show. He's a New York Times bestselling author, speaker, coach, and he specializes in confidence, relational intelligence. He's got a YouTube channel that, like, if you're dating and you haven't found his YouTube channel, are you even on YouTube? And he's got more than a 500 million views. He writes a weekly newsletter you've got to get into. He's the host of his podcast, Love Life with Matthew Hussey. And he has monthly coaching to his members of his private community at lovelifeclub.com. In the past decade and a half, he's got this proven approach that's really inspired so many people through his candor, his authenticity, his insight, practical, tactical advice. We all know we love a little practical, tactical on this show. And his book, Love Life, is coming out on April 23rd, which is when you'll be hearing this episode. And so definitely head over to lovelifebook.com. His book's going to be everywhere books are sold. Don't forget to get a copy. And we're just going to jam. And you know me, I'm going to ask him so many questions. And he lives down the street in LA. So we all know that a little follow-up is going to look like me knocking on his door. But Matt, thank you so much for coming on.
And I'm wearing white trousers.
You know, last time I came to your house, you were getting a haircut in the middle of your entryway. So, you know, every day is new for you.
You didn't have to tell everyone that part.
True story.
So I actually came over and I was getting my hair cut, which is not something I always do at home.
You have something going on over there. A whole world.
I was getting my hair. It's a lot, but launching a book is a lot. And I have to get, I have to groom in the cracks of time. Okay. And that's what was happening. I was getting groomed in the cracks of time, and Ashley came over, not invited by me, I should say, invited by my wife, Audrey. And she came over and decided to just start making fun of me in the chair because she said I looked like I was headed to a Quidditch match.
You did. Okay, guys, there's something about that hair thing, the gown that was like covering his legs and covering the chair. It looked like he was levitating on the floor getting a haircut. And I just
it was like an optical illusion.
It was an optical illusion. You're so, you know, you've got such a knack, Matt, for connecting and being so fun to be around. And it's, I think that's got to be just the secret sauce on top of all your advice is the fun. You bring the fun into your day-to-day life. I mean, I've never come to somebody's house and been so tickled by them getting a haircut. You know, like, it's just like
my hairdresser actually said about you when you left, she was like, she's hysterical. She wanted to be your best friend. She was like, she's absolutely hysterical. So she, if you ever need a new best friend, Sarah, my hairdresser, wants to be, she wants to audition for that role.
You know, I've just got a few best friends and two of them are named Sarah already. So there's something.
So she's not even, truly, she's so far down the wait list for that role. She's not even, she's bringing nothing new to the party whatsoever.
She was fun. Okay, so you've been so in it with this book because who isn't when you write a book? It's a huge deal. And there's so much that goes into having a grounded life. You've got your career, you've got your business. You and Audrey have been working so hard. Everybody who hasn't seen his wife, Audrey, she is like sunshine in a little tiny pint-sized person, French person. How do you navigate keeping your love life connected? And I imagine the answer is you can't always, but like, how do you try your best? What are some things going through your mind in the busyness of everyday life?
That's a really good question. No one's asked me that question. It's been one of the ironic things about these last few months is that it's been a real, well, firstly, anyone who's tried writing a book alongside running a company knows that it's obnoxious to think that you can pull off both of those things really well at the same time.
Yeah.
So I, you know, even just me sitting in front of a laptop and writing this book for, I started 4.5 years ago, but there were 2 years where it was pretty full on in terms of the writing process, and that took its toll. And certainly now this, you know, this process of getting out there and talking about the book, me and Audrey have had to really like think about how do we find quality time? Like, how do we sneak a weekend vacation somewhere in this? How do we, you know, we've had to sit down and have some real talks. Firstly, anytime we find ourselves bickering, like actually go, this is normal. This is actually normal. Like we're doing so much, and this book is being released, and we work together as well. And so it's, you know, it's normal what we're experiencing, and the fact that, you know, there is that tension here and there. And it never takes us long. We're the kind of couple that, you know, we bicker for 10 minutes and then we sit down and we have a conversation about it and we're like, okay, we're good.
Yeah.
But it is, we felt that. And, you know, we've had to be really intentional about saying we need to have a day this Saturday, or we need to get away for a weekend and just spend quality time together and ban each other from talking shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not give ourselves the opportunity to talk shop, because it's so easy to, when you work together, just to be talking about it all the time.
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like love and work, like I used to be in the career coaching realm. Those are the two things that they hurt you enough. They cause you heartache enough where they're going to occupy all the space in your most intimate relationships. If somebody asks you how you're doing, if you have heartbreak, it's all you can feel. It's like,
oh yeah.
If you hate your job, it's like you just sat through 8 hours of misery. It's all you can really think about, right? So it's, chances are, if you hate your job, you hate your life. Chances are, if you don't feel happy with yourself, it's going to be hard to be happy in your relationship. I know that there's so much I could ask you about relationships, but I know also your book really opens up talking about how hard being single can be. I had a friend the other day who sat down with me for 3 hours, and she's 43 years old. And she said, I really want to meet my person. Feels like it's too late to have a family, but I really want to have a family. And it's been so hard. And I ran into her recently, and she had this really young guy, like 2 decades younger, which is, I had no judgment about the age gap. But what I thought about was that she was kind of cock blocking herself at a party where there were other guys that she was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to connect her to another guy. She said, oh no, I'm seeing someone. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And then she'd shared with me that he wasn't really looking for commitment. And I felt all this air come out of my lungs. Oh, that hurts so bad to see somebody in so much pain, causing themselves so much pain, choosing things that are so painful. Why do you think so many people keep choosing so much pain in their romantic pursuits to find their person?
That's such a great question, and it's such an important example you just gave, and it's something I talk a lot about in the book. There's a chapter in this book called Have Hard Conversations, and it's all about the conversations we avoid with other people and the ways that we can find ourselves, for example, in a situationship with someone for 6 months or a year, never really having the hard conversation with that person about where it's going, because we don't want to put an end to something that we're enjoying or is bringing us short-term comfort.
Mm-hmm.
So we just keep going, and we go and we go, and we keep delaying that conversation for another day, maybe because we're afraid that, you know, we know what the answer is and it's not one we want. You know, we're afraid to ask questions that have answers that we're scared of. And partly because we just, for as long as we can, we like to practice the cognitive dissonance of maybe it will work out. Maybe it will, maybe this is the thing. And so that whole chapter is about how to have hard conversations with other people. But one of the hardest conversations we have to have, some of the hardest conversations we have to have, are with ourselves. And the big conversation we have to have with ourselves is about what I really want. What's important to me and how important is it to me? And that conversation with yourself is what we use to define our path. What is the path I am on? And it sounds like this friend has not truly, she may talk about what she wants, but she hasn't truly decided the path she's on. Mm-hmm. And when we don't do that, someone comes along and, you know, in her case, they're 20 years younger and they're sexy and they're charismatic and they're, you know, fun and they feel it's validating because they're giving you attention. And it's really easy to just say, this feels good. I'm going to do this. Never really paying attention to the fact that it is taking us so far outside of our path and jeopardizing something she may want more than anything in the world, which is a family. And that's so it's like she's saying, I'm not serious about this path by who she is dating right now. Mm-hmm. And that's that those are really sad, because that's the same person that 5 years from now or 7 years from now, or whenever her window, let's say, for having children biologically is up, that's the person who will look back on that with tremendous regret. Because grief, anyone who wants those things, who doesn't get the chance to do them, has grief to process. But what makes the grief so much worse is when we look back on our decisions and we hate ourselves for having not taken the things that we wanted more seriously, or for spending 3 years with the 23-year-old who wasn't even close to being in the same stage of life as us, who can't even say they want a relationship, let alone that they want a family.
Yeah.
And we know that we stayed in that relationship. So it's right now, it's understanding this person she's dating right now or seeing is meeting some kind of a need for her. Mm-hmm. What need is that meeting? And what is meeting that need that way costing her? And in this case, it's costing her something she probably wants as much, if not more, than anything else in her life.
You know, it's interesting. What you're sharing is about vision in some way. It's like having a vision, and it's again, it's like love and career. So many, it's like finding a partner. It's like job hunting. I just can't even, it's killing me that I think about this much, but it's like in your career, if you have a vision, it becomes easier to make, to get clear on whether something's a yes or no, because you simply look at your vision and say, is this moving me forward in this vision or not? And so it's almost like when you're choosing haphazardly based on what feels good in the moment, it's kind of like the epitome of discipline and freedom being tied. I used to think discipline was such a buzzkill, like being disciplined. You know, I used to have a lot of what I call snaccidents, like I'd eat all my little cupcakes. And then I realized, well, actually, these cupcakes are a fucking prison, because if I keep eating them, I'm going to be sick. And I'm going to be overweight, because I was getting a little puffy from my cupcakes. And so it's like the discipline of choosing your vision, the discipline of me not eating too many cupcakes gives me freedom to live my life the way I want to live it. And you're like, try not to laugh, because this is so me to say this, but
it's also just so, I have a specific memory of us all staying together in a house on a particular weekend recently. And you and I basically like scouring the storage cupboards in this house that wasn't even our house, just looking for something after we had just had an amazing dinner. And the two of us got back at like 10 or 11 o'clock and we were like looking through the cupboards for something that we could eat, something like a chocolate bar or whatever. And it was whatever snacks were there, I just remember was so depressing and not interesting.
Well, even worse, actually, speaking of, Matt, remember I told you I brought you a Rice Krispie the next day and then I ate yours? I brought you a gift.
What the fuck was that? Unbelievable. It was truly, if you
uncontrollable.
Yeah, I'm going to tell Sarah, the hairdresser, that, because she's going to be a little less interested in being your best friend when she realizes that's the kind of generosity she can expect is, I got you a gift. Oh, no, I didn't. I ate it.
Exactly. It's a trick. You know, it's so funny. I'm sitting here on my high horse on U-Turn podcast. You know, discipline is freedom, everyone. I stopped eating cupcakes. And then here we are talking about how I was scavenging the cabinets with you at midnight looking for some candy just a couple months ago and got you a gift of dessert the next day and ate it myself and revealed that to you. So I don't really know if we should listen to me. Thank God you're here.
What's weird? Can I tell you the weirdest part about that story?
Yes.
It's that you would tell me.
I know.
There's some part of you that felt that it was necessary. You couldn't have just, you bought it, you ate it. It's the perfect crime.
It could have been
just
a
leave
secret.
It there.
Yeah, but I just felt like I wanted generosity credits to say I thought of you, but I didn't think of you long enough to keep it alive.
You wanted generosity credits for giving it to me, but instead you just caused me pain by getting me excited about something that didn't exist anymore.
Oh, note to self, if I get two Rice Krispie treats and one's supposed to be yours, it's never going to make it, you know? Probably shouldn't say. Well, so, you know, going back to all this stuff, it's like,
I've got to hear this segue.
I'm just call me out so hard. I have to stay focused.
How do you segue that back in a natural way? But you can, I'm sure.
Actually, I fucking can, Matt. Here's what I was going to say is, let what you don't want be disgusting to you. Not to say that that's helpful, but I was telling this girl when she was dating this guy and like cock blocking herself at the party. And she was, you know, and then they ended up breaking up and, you know, whatever. I said, here's the thing. You need to let the thing you keep being attracted to that is hurting you. You need to let the knowing that it's going to hurt you, that it's not aligned with your vision, be gross to you. That needs to gross you out. Oh, gross. They don't want commitment. Ew. Like, I'm so past that. And so I don't know if I'm ever going to make a cupcake gross to me, but that was my segue.
No, but that is actually right on the money. There has to come a point where the things that, you know, the things that you really want, when they're missing, it actually becomes a turnoff to you. And it's not even interesting.
Yeah.
If you can't make it gross, at least get to the point of going, God, this isn't interesting to me.
Yeah.
You're not sure you don't know if you want a relationship at this point in your life. Not interesting to me.
Yeah.
Like, because it can't make me happy. And by the way, look only to your own past for how that's actually true. It's not a game you have to play with yourself. You don't have to do a mind trick on yourself. Just look at your own history and go, when I didn't feel safe with someone because they weren't showing they wanted me, or they weren't showing they really were choosing me, how did that feel?
Yeah.
Like, did it feel good? It definitely didn't. You felt a longing.
Mm-hmm.
You may have been attracted to that person, but it didn't feel good. It felt like anxiety every single day.
Yeah.
It felt like insecurity every single day. It didn't feel good. And if we get in touch with that, I remember being in a relationship where I was anxious all the time. And I remember a friend of mine, she saw me one day while I was in that relationship. She never told me this at the time, but after the breakup, she said, and this was someone who hadn't seen me in a little while, so she knew who I was in a normal context. And she said, I left you that day in the middle, when you were in the middle of that relationship, I left you that day and I went to my sister's house and I told her, oh, Matt is not happy. And she felt it. Like, for her, it was palpable that I was not myself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd have asked me at the time, I wouldn't have necessarily told you I was really unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was just so busy trying to hold on to this relationship. And that was monopolizing all of my energy and all of my attention. I think what a lot of us are not good at, myself included, in those moments and in life in general, perhaps, is actually tuning into how something makes us feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is this person making me feel? Forget how impressive I think they are, or how desirable I think they are, or how eligible I think they are. How does this person make me feel? How do I feel right now? And it can take some effort to tune in to that. Like for a lot of us who are out of practice,
yeah,
it can take effort. Like I had a friend who I remember we had a sort of budding friendship. And then every time I left this person, I had this strange feeling of feeling worse about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't, at first I paid no attention to it, because that was my pattern, is like not paying attention to how someone makes me feel.
Mm-hmm.
And Audrey has helped me pay more attention to my feelings in that way. And we ended up talking about it. And I was like, you know, it's in some subtle way, being around this person, there's usually some very discreet or subtle way that they put me down, or they say something that makes me feel just a little bit like insecure in a way that I didn't feel when I showed up.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? I can't. And it was like hard to put my finger on, but at a certain point I went, this person doesn't make me feel good.
Like, and that's all, like, right? Like, we don't have to know why. That's it.
No.
Thing. I think that's why people bypass it, is they get stuck in the why and they have to figure it out, and they're over responsible with blaming themselves. It's maybe sometimes it's just chemistry. Everybody's a cocktail. 1 + 1 = 2. And is it a nice 2 or a not so nice 2?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's interesting too, because I dated one guy for 3 years, and looking back, I'm sure him plus someone else he wasn't a toxic person, you know? Him plus someone else is probably I could see it being a good cocktail. Him plus me wasn't. It didn't make me mean. It didn't make me bad. It didn't make him mean or bad. But our needs were at direct conflict with each other's all the time.
This is a really, really important point you're making, because it is really easy to get stuck in the who's right, who's wrong of it all. Are they really being out of order in what they're doing? Are they, you know, is there something wrong with them? Are they a narcissist? Aren't they a narcissist? Like, people get stuck in trying to diagnose the situation. And what you just said is super important, because what matters is compatibility. And there's a chapter in the book, How to Tell Love Stories. It's near the beginning of the book. And the whole chapter really is about, it really matters what we call a true love story and what we don't, because it will determine where we put our energy. It will determine how long we cry over someone, and when we decide enough is enough and they're not worth crying over anymore or at all. And in this chapter, I lay out the 4 stages of importance, or the 4 levels of importance in any situation with a person. The level 1 is admiration. And that's just when we think someone's hot or great or important or eligible or whatever impresses us about them. Mm-hmm. Now, level 1's not important, because level 1 is just, you know, you admiring someone. It doesn't mean that there's anything there. Level 2 is mutual attraction. Mutual attraction is 2 people who actually give each other attention. There's some chemistry, there's some connection, there's something going on there. This is where all the problems start, because when we feel that with someone, it feels really rare, and it feels, you know, we often don't like someone, and then when they like us back, it's like, oh my God, this is the holy grail. This is everything. It's nothing without level 3, which is commitment. Mm-hmm. Commitment is someone saying yes. It's the thing your friend didn't have. She's got level 2. And because she's got level 2, it feels like the most important thing in the world right now. But he's not saying yes. He's not saying, I want a relationship. So really, she has nothing. Mm-hmm. But it feels like everything. Mm-hmm. And then when we have level 3, commitment, there's still a level 4. And level 4 is compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
Compatibility is, do we work together?
Mm-hmm.
Are you good at handling me? Am I good at handling you? You know, there's obviously huge amount of work out there on attachment styles. You know, you could be anxiously attached. You're going to need someone who helps you feel safe.
Yeah.
Not everyone is going to help you feel safe. And that doesn't make them evil. It doesn't make them wrong. It doesn't make them a terrible person. But some people are going to absolutely inflame the things that you just can't afford to be inflamed because of who you are.
And the amount of people who look at themselves and personal development, there's so much personal development out there about being your best self and looking at yourself and taking responsibility. And in one way, it's great. Another way, it's totally toxic in the sense where sometimes the real work for someone is self-acceptance. And instead of saying, I need to be better, I need to be less anxious, it's saying, I have this thing, I've been working on it. This person makes it harder.
That's exactly right. Is this person a healing presence for me, or are they an agitating presence? And it's, yes, it's incumbent on us to do the work, to try to be our best and to bring our best energy to someone. But we have to remember that some people make it easier for us to bring our best energy and some people make it harder. And it's important to know the difference.
Yeah. It's, you know, so interesting speaking about like dreams and visions. Number one, I think there's a really fine line between, you know, vision and delusion, right? Like sometimes we're like, I've got a vision. And it's not to say that I say the word delusion to put down somebody's big, beautiful dream. But sometimes I find that some of my friends who really want to find love are in such a fantasy vision. And some of the things don't feel reasonable, right? Does it really matter that he's 6'4" and he has like an 8-pack of abs? And you touched on something, Matt, that I love. You talked about the distinction of who somebody is to the world and admiring that versus who they are to you.
Huge. That's huge.
And people miss that, right? They're caught in the list and they're like, this is who they are and box, box, box. But I'm like, yeah, but they treat you like shit. What are you choosing? So
my favorite is this. It's people saying, I have really high standards and that's my problem, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now,
when you explore that, here's what you find. They have really high standards about things that are often not that important. And they have almost no standards for things that are.
Oh my gosh.
Because there'll be, you know, I have really high standards for who I get attracted to, you know, for who I think is good looking, or, you know, their style or who they are in life or any of these things. And so that's why I struggle to meet people who I like. And that's why I can't get my mind off this person who's been in my life for the last 3 years. And you go, well, tell me about that person. And then you hear the stories about this person, about how this person treats them, about how they pick them up and put them down, how they completely take them for granted, how this person's wildly entitled, how they're selfish, how they treat them badly. And you go, so what you mean is you have all these standards around all these superficial things, but apparently you have no standards for kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Because this person's been completely selfish and unkind in the way they've treated you for a long time. So, or you have no standards for the consistency you expect in your relationships, or you have no standards for someone choosing you.
Mm-hmm.
When we say we have high standards, it's all very a la carte. Mm-hmm. We have very high standards over here and very low standards over here, but we don't talk about that. And that's the part that I try to address with people is, yes, have high standards, but have high standards about things that actually determine your quality of life.
Mm.
And much of the time we haven't really been honest with ourselves about what are the things that determine my quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how at home do I feel with someone? How much does this person make me more of myself?
Mm.
How accepted do I feel by this person? How much empathy do I feel from them? Do you know all of these things that truly matter? How good of a team do we make?
Mm-hmm.
And I think once we start getting really present with those things, we start realizing a lot of the things that we may have been selecting for previously are more to do with what feeds our ego than what makes us happy.
Yeah, it's, you know, but you're touching on an interesting sweet spot here because, well, maybe it's not so sweet spot. Let me share what it is, but it feels like there's a fine line between let's work on this, let's improve, you're human, I'm human, and let's close the door, this isn't healthy. And I think a lot of people listening, a lot of people in the world, they need to accept that what they're in isn't healthy, it's not good for them. But I also think there's some people almost like with the same story of I have high standards, that they don't want to stick around and work something out. Like there's the grass is greener, which is the other thing, right? Oh, you know, we just don't get along about this. I'm out, you know, because and that's a whole nother masquerade of fear of vulnerability is like never really going in. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on people who like are constantly thinking the grass is greener? Because I imagine some people are listening and maybe they're thinking, well, you know, I think I've gotten past some of this, but I think I have some of it still. How do I know when I should just work it out with somebody and the grass is not greener, you know?
Yeah. There will be people that by being around them, we genuinely feel like I am a worse version of myself, that this person is really devoid of basic values that to me are the most important values. And frankly, we speak a different language. You know, there are people that when you argue with them, you realize like we fundamentally speak a different language. You think it's okay to consistently lie and I value honesty. Mm-hmm. You show no compassion for me and I am really accepting of you. You know, that there are certain people that we realize we're not playing by the same rules. Mm-hmm. You're willing to completely gaslight me and distort my reality. And I'm actually like trying to have an authentic relationship with you and meet you at a place of truth. And when you realize you're playing by different rules, that's a real reason not to be there because you realize, oh, this is poison for me. But what I see you referring to is situations where we're not saying someone's poison to us. We're not saying they play by a completely different set of rules. It's that we realize we're dealing with an imperfect person, albeit an imperfect person who may still be kind and may still ultimately have good intentions. And when it really comes down to it, we know that we're dealing with a good human being who's doing their best. And I think it's sad the way that we write people off. And I find that, you know, look, to use myself as an example, the more I felt like as I got older, life punched me in the face. And the more I was humbled by some really difficult experiences in life, the more I was humbled by mistakes that I made that I never thought I would make, the more through all of those very humbling experiences, I accepted myself and my own difficulties and challenges and flaws. The more I became accepting of those things in other people, because I think a lot of the time we reject other people, the lack of compassion we're showing other people is very indicative of the lack of compassion we are showing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we write people off because it's kind of, we're wanting to attain this perfection or this kind of person that gets us as far away from ourselves as possible. I think of it like kids, you know, in teenagers who really feel insecure and they don't feel cool. When you don't feel cool and you haven't accepted yourself and your own weirdness and your own quirks, the last thing you want is to be seen around other uncool people. You're like, I don't want to, if you're a weirdo, if there's stuff about you that kind of reminds me of me in some way, I don't want to be around you. I want to be around the cool people and hope that by being next to them, people think I'm cool too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think a very similar thing happens to us as adults in our love lives, where there are certain people that feel a bit too close to home for us. They remind us of ways that we ourselves don't feel cool, ways that we ourselves don't feel we've made it, ways that we worry we're not good enough. And when we meet someone like that, it's like being back at school and going, get the hell away from me. You're gonna out me. I don't wanna, by being with you, people are gonna think that I'm that way too. And that's the last thing I want, because I haven't accepted these things in myself. So let me find someone who's cool enough and hot enough and successful enough and all these things enough that I can blend in and people will think I'm worth something by being with them. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a lot of that. And when people say to me, you know, there's a thing that happens with a lot of people who do self-development, where they get to a point where they're like, I just find it so hard, you know, to find people these days, because, you know, I've done all of this work and there's this humble brag of all
snobbery,
these wonderful things. And it's just now hard to find someone who's as awesome as I am. And I always find it to be this weird, I feel like when people say it, they don't quite realize the contradiction or the hypocrisy in what they're saying. Because for me, the genuine work I've done on myself, not the like posturing of look how much work I've done on myself, but the genuine work I've done on myself has always made me more accepting of myself. And in being more accepting of myself, it has made me more accepting of others. And I believe when we become more accepting of others, when we have more compassion and generosity towards the flaws of other people, our pool actually opens up. It doesn't contract. And so what I would encourage people to do is pursue whatever, I don't care what work you do, but pursue whatever is going to help you accept the parts of yourself that you've found difficult to accept in your life. And when you do, and you see other people with struggling with those things, it will breed warmth in you, and it will breed compassion in you, and you'll want to see if offering that person acceptance and love and kindness is something that invites that person to a greater degree of safety. And within that safety, a lot of people suddenly blossom in these really interesting ways. And so you become someone who other people kind of blossom around, because you make other people feel safe through your acceptance and the way you show up with them. And that's just a wonderful thing to be in life, is someone who has that effect on other people. But B, you really do, by doing that, you invite people. It's a really crazy thing when you think about it, because you invite people to a version of themselves that they may have never been for anyone else. They no one may have had a version of them that's that good, because you're inviting them into a safe kind of zone where they're able to blossom in those ways. So I often think that the way we judge people and the way we write people off, it stokes the very insecurities and the very inadequacies and the worries that turn that person into the worst version of themselves. Because when they're now feeling judged, because they can feel it, and when they're feeling shamed for the way they are, it just brings out whatever their worst tendencies are. And then it justifies, you know, we feel validated in saying, yeah, they were the worst, or yeah, they were crazy. Yeah, they were, you know, too insecure for me, or too... And so we kind of end up precipitating this thing where no one is really good enough, instead of being the person that that brings out someone's best. And by the way, a lot of people won't rise to that invitation either, but I think you learn more by giving people that invitation and seeing if they can rise to it than you do by kind of writing people off, not for the deeper qualities they have, if they've got the good stuff, but for the kind of some of the surface level behaviors and tendencies that may initially frustrate us, which, welcome to the world. I mean, yeah. good luck having a relationship with someone where there aren't going to be things about them that frustrate you or behaviors they have that frustrate you. Mm-hmm. I know that was a long-winded answer, but I hope there was something.
No, I mean, honestly, 100%. And okay, so with your book coming out and everybody remember Love Life, and I want to read the subtitle because I feel like everybody can, how to raise your standards, find your person, and live happily no matter what. So there is a version of you, Matt, forever ago that, you know, wasn't the person that knew all that you know now. And I think there's some people out there that they feel like, oh, I'm just not where I want to be. You know, like I'm so disappointed in my love life. I'm not where I want to be. What would be your message to your younger self that wasn't where he wanted to be, or to anyone listening who isn't where they want to be?
So I want to give that message to my younger self and to everyone else out there, but I also want to give this message to my older self who didn't find love. Because there's a version of me that didn't find love and is mourning the loss of that great love that he wished to have met, and is in experiencing a kind of chronic emotional pain of loneliness and a yearning for love that has not been satisfied. And that is what happens for so many people in this life. And we don't acknowledge them nearly enough. Many of those people, they feel invisible, and they feel like it's almost shameful for them to admit how much they're hurting because they've never found love, or because they lost love and they haven't found anything like it since. We live in a culture that even shames people for looking for love. You know, we all, it's like the worst kept secret that every single one of us deeply, deeply wants to find love, but we have to somehow go through life pretending like it doesn't matter that much to us. You know, if it happens, it happens. Whatever, I'm fine. I enjoy what I do. Like, I don't care. We have to feign this indifference because, God forbid, we actually admit, I really do want to find love. There's nothing wrong with wanting to find love. It is deeply human. We all want to find love. And there is nothing wrong with you if right now you feel in pain because you're lonely. Mm-hmm. You feel in pain because you have a deep longing for romantic love and for intimacy, and the kind of love and intimacy that friends can't always provide, and that family can't provide, and that there is a specific kind of love that we yearn for, and life is messy in that department. And it, you know, we can think we found it and then we lose it. Some people never find it. What I would say to people, there's a chapter in this book that is highly practical called Happy Enough, where I talk about tools for managing chronic emotional pain, which is what people struggle with when they want to find love and it hasn't happened or isn't happening. So I have a whole list of tools in there that have helped me in my life and have helped many, many thousands, and at this point, hundreds of thousands of other people in that chapter. One of the things that I talk about in that chapter, and by the way, the whole point of those tools is to get people to a place where they are happy enough, not blissfully happy. I really don't have a lot of patience for the constant advice out there about you just have to find, be truly happy on your own first. And I think, what is this nonsense? Like, it's people, who's saying this? Firstly, if they're single and they're saying that, maybe they've achieved that. Maybe, but probably they haven't. Mm-hmm. And they're just telling you something that they've made themselves kind of indifferent to and detached from because it's too painful for them to acknowledge what they feel they're missing in their lives. And if they're married and they're telling you, you've got to be blissfully happy before you find a person, well, how easy for them to say from the safety of their long-term relationship that they go home to every night. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I find it to be a really insidious piece of advice that's given out because it makes people feel inadequate for not being able to experience it. Happy enough, though, happy enough is achievable. And if you learn how to manage your relationship with the difficult feelings that we have while on the search for love, you can get to a place where you are happy enough. And happy enough is a superpower. Because when you're happy enough, you're just happy enough that you can say no to the wrong thing. You're happy enough to hold. You're happy enough to say no to the person 2 decades younger who doesn't want the same things as you. You're happy enough to be yourself when you meet someone that is really awesome and not become something else because you're afraid that if you lost them, your world would be over. And you're happy enough to be present with your life as it is today while acknowledging and wanting, by the way, that, you know, I do want a relationship. And you can even acknowledge, I might be even happier if I found an amazing relationship. If I found my person, I'd probably be even happier. You know, but I am happy enough today that I don't feel like my life is on hold waiting for that to happen. And by the way, here's the other kind of paradoxical thought. When you're happy enough, you kind of feel like you don't really have anything to lose. And when you don't have anything to lose, that's when you go out and take big swings in your life. Because, you know, you feel like I'm happy to return to the life I have tomorrow morning. If I go on this date and nothing comes of it, if I ask this person out and I get rejected, I am happy enough with my life the way it is. Not that I, because people I think associate this with being comfortable and being passive. No, it's not. It's actually you're happy enough that you can go and take, it's like business. If you're happy enough with the way your business is, you can actually take big swings because everything doesn't feel life or death. You're like, if this doesn't come off, who cares? I love my business. I love what I'm doing. I love the way it is every day. So I can go and take that big swing because I'm happy to return to the status quo if nothing comes of it. When you feel like it's life and death, that's when you're afraid to take a risk because you're like, if it comes off, I'll never survive the, if it doesn't come off, I'll never survive the disappointment. So happy enough is a superpower. And for anyone who reads that chapter, you'll get the tools to be happy enough where you stand right now. But the last thing I'll say, just because it kind of gives people a kind of window into some of this, is one of the most important lessons I ever learned was just that everything changes. Everything changes. You don't know where your life is going to be a year from now. You really don't. You don't know what love could come into your life a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now. You have no idea. This feeling you have now will change. The way you relate to your life will change. The way you relate to life in general will change. The people you meet will change. And by the way, that's also true in the adverse sense that you everything changes in the when you find good things too. Mm-hmm. You can lose them. There are people that you're envious of right now and their relationship, and they won't be in that relationship in 5 years.
You know, it's like time zones. Like I write about in my book, it's some people in LA, you know, we're not really eating dinner at 3 p.m., but people in New York are. It's time for them to eat. It's like your life. It's like your career. It's like these cadences that you're talking about. And I think so many people feel like they're moving forward when they're grabbing onto things, but they're actually moving backward because they have to undo those things.
That's exactly right. You can find a casual relationship that brings you comfort right now, and it's with someone who's totally wrong for you or wants completely different things than you do. And it feels like progress when you go to your friends and you say, I'm seeing someone. And by the way, that you have a friend that when you say, I'm seeing someone, you have a single friend who secretly in her mind is, here's me still left on the shelf. Like now, even Jane is seeing someone. Like, but what you don't know about Jane is that her seeing someone is a guy 2 decades younger than her who doesn't even want a relationship, but is taking up her mental bandwidth right now and her emotional space. And in 2 years, she's not going to be with him anymore. And she's going to be back out there. You can literally go slow for 2 years trying to meet the right person and still, you know, no, I don't want to put it like this, but you know what I mean? Still be further ahead than she is because she's got 2 years now of locked being up. This guy where it's not going anywhere. And yeah. I think of stories like this all the time. Like one of my heroes was Anthony Bourdain. And he, you know, my publisher, Karen Rinaldi, was actually the person who published Kitchen Confidential, the book that made him the Tony Bourdain that everyone knows. And you know, his story is so profound to me because it has so many twists and turns. Like, here's a guy who is in his early 40s and is broke and working in a kitchen and has a bunch of debt. And then he sends off an email that leads to someone going, oh my God, this is great. Here's a book deal. Mm-hmm. And then that book blows up. And all of a sudden, most people who hit 40 and are broken in debt feel like, I've really made giant errors in my life. That's it. I've, you know. And then here he is at 42, 43, whenever that book got released. And all of a sudden is a phenomenon in the book world and then goes on to make a TV show that makes him that, and this was even before Parts Unknown, makes No Reservations and becomes a hit in the TV world. And then like Parts Unknown in his 50s elevates him into a kind of rock star status. And then I remember, you know, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He took up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at, I think it was like 57, something like that. And it was so inspiring to me because he literally trained so hard and got his blue belt. And I was like, oh my God, I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in my 30s. And I thought that was late. And here's someone starting in their late 50s and is in amazing shape and is doing so well. And I was just like, God, anyone who feels like they're late to the party, either with a sport or with their career, he is just this incredible, what I would call an emotional button for the fact that none of those things are true. And anyone would look at him and go, man, he's so far ahead. And then he ends it all. And you're like, what did being far ahead even count for at that point? Because he was so unhappy or there's so much going on for him mentally. I'll never know what those things were, but there must have been so much going on for him mentally that we get to a point where you go, oh my God, this is the person that I'm thinking is so far ahead. And now what does it count for? And that story has such profound meaning for me because how many of us feel like we're behind in life? Mm-hmm. How many of us feel like we're not where we should be by now? Mm-hmm. How many of us are looking at someone else going, they have my dream, they're married, they have kids, they have it. I deal with people all the time on the other side of that equation who are going through the worst divorces of their lives, who are going through hell. They are dealing with a person who is a narcissist that they've now got a co-parent with for the next 15 years. And it's, you just don't know. And you may not be behind. You may be telling yourself you're behind and you are absolutely not behind. You are right now beginning a new story and you get to choose what that next story is. But when we rush and we panic and we think we're behind and we think that we've messed it all up in life and we're not where we should be, that's where we hurry the next story. And when we do that, we can end up living out a new story that brings us an awful lot of pain and suffering. So go slow to go fast.
Yeah.
Be intentional about the next story that you embark on, and realize that if you're still here and you're listening to this and you're still breathing, then there's room for many more stories in your life yet. And that should be, you know, that should be a very encouraging thing.
You're listening. I feel like just a friendly reminder, you're in the world for so many things, and the last thing you need is a love life that pulls you away from them or dampers your life force energy, makes it harder for you to do the things you're here for. I'm so excited, Matt, you have this book coming out. I'm really proud of you. I feel so lucky to be friends. I love you and Audrey. I appreciate you both. And I think what's so special about you and her is the realness. And people talk about that. But I feel like the energy you bring to your work is not like a digital marketing, let's get bigger energy. It's a, and I'm sure we're all business owners, but it's an energy of, I really believe this and I really think this, and people are meeting you there. So I'm so excited for you listening to get a copy of Love Life. And of course, I know, Matt, you have lovelifebook.com. Is there anywhere else that you'd want people to go to get a vibe with you on this?
I mean, people can come over and listen to the Love Life podcast if you enjoy listening to me in podcast form. And you can listen to that wherever you listen to podcasts. But the big thing right now, I think books are these uniquely but valuable things, because by definition, if I make a YouTube video, I've put a few hours into that video. I've put hundreds of hours into this book, and you know, books are cheap. So it's kind of by definition, it's going to be one of the most valuable things that you can get from a person, is this thing that they've spent a disproportionate amount of time on. And it's the cheapest thing they probably have to offer.
Yeah.
So I would just say to someone, if you really want to engage with what I'm doing right now, I think the book is the greatest value thing that you can possibly get from me. You can get a copy at lovelifebook.com, and there's lots of retailers on there, whether you're in the States or whether you're international, you'll find retailers on there for both. And I'm also doing an event exclusively for book buyers on May the 4th called Find Your Person, where we're going to take the ideas from the book and bring them to life in a practical way in your year this year, which is going to be a lot of fun. And everyone who gets a copy of the book, I think it's within a couple of weeks. I think it's by the midnight on the 3rd of May. So long as you get a book by then, you get a free ticket to that event. And you can see all the details for how to access that ticket on lovelifebook.com. Basically, you take your receipt and you use it to get that ticket. So all of that, both the chance to buy the book and to get that ticket, is all on lovelifebook.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much again.
You're very welcome. It's so lovely to be with you, Ashley. I've loved it. It's such a fun conversation. I love hanging out with you, and me and Audrey are such huge fans of you. And it's fun to actually, this is our first time doing anything
business,
you know, with anyone else present. So it's been a joy. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning into the U-Turn podcast. And thank you again so much for our sponsors. We are here because of you. And to our listeners, thank you for checking out our sponsors. We always pick people and brands that we trust and we believe in. And just for listening to the show, writing your reviews on the Apple app, and just being willing to make your own U-turns. We'll see you next week.